This lecture on the book of Genesis was held at the Jewish Center on December 15th, 1960. I think last time we ended with Cain and Hevel, the beginning of the story of Cain and Abel. The lessons in the story, in the narrative of the Torah, the apparent lessons, the obvious ones, also those that are more obscure and that have to be searched out. We discussed the enmity between them, why seemingly God cares for one and doesn't care for the other, and the commentary that the whole narrative has on the nature of sacrifices, that not the sacrifice is the main thing, but the man, El Hevel ben Melchoso Shah, Ve'el Kayan Ve'el Melchoso Lo Shah. Also, the fact that when it comes to sacrifice, and therefore worship, because the sacrifice is simply a form of worship, that what counts more than the actual gift, more than the saying of the words or the bringing of the animal, is the thought, the kavana, the intention, the whole attitude, the religious attitude of the worshipper himself. Now let's continue with what we regard as the most difficult verse in the whole narrative, and that is page 6, verse 7. God turns to Cain, who feels very distraught, very depressed, because of the rejection of his gift. And God says to him, "Lama charalacha v'lama naflu fanecha? Why are you angry and why has your face fallen? Why are you so obviously aggravated or excited?" And then God says these significant words, which are really perhaps the essence of the whole thing. Halo imtativ se'es. If you will do good, se'es. I'm leaving that untranslated because that's the key. The translation of this word determines what the whole sentence means. V'im lo se'ativ, if you will not do good, then la pesach, at the door, chatos roves, sin crouches, like a lion ready to pounce on the victim. Sin crouches at the door. Ve'elecha teshukaso, his longing is for thee. Ve'ata timshal bo, but you may rule over him. A verse that's significant not only to understand the episode of Cain and Abel, but a verse that's significant in order to understand the whole drama of man, the whole religious drama of man. Now, what does the word se'es mean? It's a strange word. It's similar to Hebrew words, but the structure is different. The Malbim, one of the much later commentaries, connects the word se'es to masas. What does the word masas or mashas mean? A gift. Matana. It's a gift. Masas. Mashas ma'uma. A free gift. A gift given by one's free will, voluntarily. And he says as follows. Imtativ se'es. If you will do good, then se'es, that itself is in place of a gift. It's a very queer construction now. Halo imtativ se'es. That will be your gift, the doing good. See, Cain had given God an object, and he had imagined that by giving that object to the Rabbanu Shalom, that will propitiate the deity, that will satisfy him, or gratify him. And then he suddenly finds that God rejects him despite his giving a gift. Here he goes ahead and gives part of his substance, and he finds that it isn't enough. There seems to be something else that God wants, so why does God reject his gift? So God says to him, "Halo imtativ se'es, I don't want your gift. The gift that I demand of you, if I demand of you a physical gift, is only because this has to be symbolic of a state of mind, of an attitude. If I insist upon it, it's only because I want this to induce a certain attitude in you, but if the attitude is missing, then it's meaningless. The real gift that you can give to God, the real gift that any man can give to God when it comes to worship, is essentially imtative, to be good. Halo imtativ se'es, if you will do good, that is the se'es, that is the gift. V'im lo se'ativ, because if you're not going to do good, then no gift will help, because la pesach chatos roves. Sin crouches at the door, it's going to spring at you, and no gift is going to protect you. So that The entire verse, according to Malbim, is a commentary on the nature of worship and the nature of sacrifice again. Halom Tetiv says, that is what I want. Otherwise, it's irrelevant. This is essentially the theme of the prophets, who maintain that it's true that that the Torah decrees karbonos, the Torah decrees sacrifices. But the sacrifice is only a visible symbol of the invisible, unexpressed attitude of man. And if the attitude is wrong, how do we know the attitude is wrong? By the fact that the same person who brings the sacrifice and donates the golden doors to the temple is the one who oppresses the widow and the orphan and the worker, the one who steals, the one who murders, the one who consorts with gangsters. This sort of gift is obviously only an attempt to propitiate some kind of divine tyrant. And that isn't what God wants from man. What God wants from man is a gift that is given in an attitude of lev nishbara, broken heart. Tefillah la'ani ki yatov, the prayer of the poor man when he feels despondent. It means we must approach God with a feeling of submissiveness, and therefore to destroy our own arrogance. But if man approaches God arrogantly, no words and no gift has any meaning. The whole reason for the words and for the gift is to induce the right attitude. If you haven't got the right attitude, then you've overlooked the main reason for them. So this is the interpretation according to Malbim. Others would disagree with that interpretation. They would say that it's stretching a bit to say that se'es means, although it's similar to mas'es, but it's stretching it a bit because it seems if you look at the verse carefully, there are two antithetical conditions, two antonyms, im seitiv, im lo seitiv, if you do good and if you don't do good. And you have to divide the whole concept of what God says to Cain along these two. Yes, that's kasudas, that's what I'm coming to now. Very good. The word say from the word to lift oneself up. Therefore, what would se'es mean? To be able to stand proud, straight, and erect. To be able to stand on your own two feet. To feel human dignity. To be able to stand straight with your shoulders thrown back and your chest out, your chin up. And therefore, this is the meaning of the verse. Imitative, if you will lead the good life, se'es. You'll be a man of dignity. Because what were the words that God just said before that? Now look at this, even this kasuta missed this, and it's perfect proof to him. Lama charalach, why are you so wroth, so tense, so excited? V'lama naflu panacha, why has your face fallen? Imtative, if you'll do good, your face won't fall, you'll stand up straight. You see? So God approaches him in a personal way. He says, look at your, and uses the idiom, emotionally you feel downcast, a fallen face. Well, look, my friend, getting out of the emotional into the ethical, if you want to lead a life of happiness, of dignity, then you've got to lead a decent life. You can't expect to have emotional rewards for a life of corruption. Emotional rewards will come for a life of decency. So then the two sides are as follows. Halo imtative, se'es. Now, what is the opposite of imtative, if you will do good? Imlotative. You won't do good. The next half of the verse. And what is the opposite of the verb se'es, to stand straight? Rovates. To lie down, to crouch. So the meaning would be this. Look, Cain, if you will lead the good life, then you will be a man of dignity. You will be able to stand straight. If you're going to lead a corrupt life, then remember that sin crouches at the door. And what is it going to do to you? What is it going to do to you? Pull you down with him. Sin will pull you down. Instead of being, say, standing up straight, it will pull you down. So what is the concept involved here? The concept we came across before. How do we call it in Hebrew? Jerry, I think you mentioned it 2 weeks ago or last week. Avera? Gorera savera. An old Jewish concept. That one sin pulls along another. So what God tells Cain is, if you don't do a sin, in other words, if you have a temptation to disobey, and you struggle with it, and you conquer it, then you stand straight. In other words, what do you stand straight? We imagine that sin lies crouching at the door. You're free from it. Sin lies down. You're standing up. But if you submit once, and you submit a second time and a third time, then you keep on going lower. You bend down to the level of chadas. And you yourself become on par with that symbol of sin. Because avera goreres avera. If you recall what we said last time, this is a commentary on man's freedom, on human freedom. We have free will, but no one has complete free will. Very few people have destroyed their freedom completely. The way to increase the area of freedom is to be able to wrestle with a temptation or with any will towards evil and conquer it. That means I have more freedom in the future in any of my actions. But once I submit, then submissiveness to sin, to evil, becomes habitual. And I no longer have freedom. In other words, whether I will have freedom a year from now or a day from now, I can determine now by the habits I develop and the friends I choose. The friends I choose are also important. If I choose a society which will naturally influence me in one direction, I automatically close the area of freedom. I circumscribe it. It means I no longer will have the choice. If I go into a society where, for instance, television is regarded as a sort of narcotic, it's the highest good, and I can do nothing but watch television. Study or discussion or conversation or a lecture is looked down upon and ridiculed. If I consciously join that kind of group, then I consciously limit my freedom as far as my intellectual experience is concerned. I never will study. I never will. Or if I will, it will require a tremendous effort of the will.
I think freedom here is a bad word, because you can reverse the situation and say, if you put yourself in a society that accepts certain values and you become entrenched in that society, then you again are no longer free to try the opposite.
I would agree with you if we're on an equal plane. In other words, what you're saying is, if I join a society of people who value study.
If you're brought up, for example, in a kosher home and your whole society around you is kosher, then by being kosher, you are limiting your freedom. Also,
true,
if you want to use the word freedom, then you're hesitant to eat non-kosher.
There's only one difference, and there's certain facts of life. That somehow it's easier to turn from kosher to treif than from treif to kosher. Sin is always crouching at the door. The Yetzer Hara is stronger than the Yetzer Tov.
But freedom is still a bad word.
Well, no. Yes, freedom. You see, you can train yourself into good habits, but it's always easier to pick up a bad habit. It's always easier to pick up. It's much more difficult to train a child into politeness than to corrupt a child from politeness into coarseness.
Except that you can train a child to keep kosher. And it's no burden on a child, because the child doesn't know the difference.
But what happens once the child comes into contact with the temptation to violate it?
Well, then he is so far entrenched in the society that it might be difficult. And he doesn't have the freedom not to.
No, it's not a. You have to balance, Paul. I'll give you an example.
For example, when you became 18, did you really feel that you had the freedom to go out and have a hot dog at the baseball game? Or is there something holding you back? You weren't absolutely free.
Not a hot dog, but variations of it.
Or whatever your desire happens to be.
Yes. Look, the religious man, a religious individual, always has a struggle. The struggle within the heart of a religious individual and his experience is a never-ending thing. People who tell you that it's the easiest thing to be religious, all your problems are solved, don't know what they're talking about. They've never been religious. Mm-hmm. But to be religious means to have, on a certain level, to have tranquility. On a certain other level, to have to make constant decisions. I've constantly got to redecide a thing, for the simple reason that it's always difficult to stand higher than it is to stand lower. To have se'es is always more difficult than to be a roves. You have to defy a certain gravity. To give you an example again, we believe that man has two inclinations, yetzer tov and yetzer hara. The good inclination for good and inclination for evil. Which is stronger? Which is stronger?
Evil.
Absolutely. Absolutely so. That's why when we say in the Shema, V'yahavtus Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha, what do Chazal say? What do the rabbis say? All thy heart. I shall love the Lord thy God with all thy heart. They say, how many words are there in Hebrew for heart? Lev and levav. Why do we use here the word levavcha, levav? The extra bays is numerically two. So the rabbis say it stands for both yitzarim. You have to love God with both inclinations. Not only with the inclination to do good, but also the inclination to do evil, because it's much more powerful, much more important. That's why the rabbis say, when the Torah says that God created the world and God saw v'hinei tov, it was good, v'yara kim ki tov. When he created man, what does it say? Ki tov ma'od was very good. You know what the rabbis say? They divide the words ki tov and tov ma'od. God saw it was good refers to the yetzer tov, the inclination for good, man's propensity for construction and constructiveness. And when it says tov ma'od, he saw it was very good, yetzer hara. That was the evil inclination. So the rabbis say to Rav Meir, who says this, how can you possibly say such a thing? That the yetzer tov is good, but the yetzer hara is very good. I mean, is it common sense? And so he says, yes. She'omola yetzer hara, if not for that yetzer hara, lo bono adam bayis, v'lo nosa isha, v'lo nata karam. If not for the yetzer hara, a man would never build a house, plant a vineyard, or marry a woman. In other words, if you have only the yetzer tov, you are a goody-goody. If you take the yetzer hara and channel it, then you have achieved greatness. That's why the Rabbah Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, says in a famous passage, in Pogaboch Menuval Zem Ashkeyol Besmedrish. Well, if you know Yiddish, you know what the word Menuval means. Menuval, how would you say it in English? It's hard to say that. Well, I suppose there is an English word, but I wouldn't mention it in present company. A lowlife, a hooligan, a scoundrel, a tramp. If this Menuval meets you, but who does the Menuval mean? The Yetzer Hara. You meet up with sudden temptation, what should you do? Mashcheyol Besmedrish, drag him into the study hall. What does this mean in psychoanalytic terms? How would you translate that? Sublimate. You have a strong libido? Sublimate it. Instead of using it for what we consider wrong ends, don't destroy that Yetzer Hara. Don't suppress it. Sublimate it. It's not kibush hayetzer, but kiddush hayetzer. Not the suppression of the instincts, but the channeling of the instincts. Use it for education. Use it for Torah. And therefore, take the Yetzer Hara and use it for v'yahavta Hashem Elokecha, for the love of God, for the constructive religious life. I'll never forget when I first, as a college sophomore, when I first came into Rabbi Soloveitchik's shiur, and he was very upset that day, as he normally was during shiurim. Whenever he's creative intellectually, he gets very excited, and he's no longer as himself. He's transported. And he said something, and we questioned him, and he got angry. And he was extremely upset that because we didn't anticipate an answer that he had in mind somehow. And so he turned around, and he caught my gaze. He said, the trouble with you is, he said, that you come into class with the Yetzer Tov, and you leave the Yetzer Hara outside. Next time you come into this class, bring in the Yetzer Hara with you. And he was right, basically. If you can't study Torah with the Yetzer Tov, this is strong enough. It's a very weak thing. When you study, you've got to study with the Yetzer Hara. With most high school youngsters, the problem is if we can get them to put the same dedication that they do into intramural basketball into their geometry, we would get someplace in their geometry. But they don't. They use a little bit instinct for the good they put into the studies, and the Yetzer Hara they put elsewhere. Then it becomes a problem. So that the Yetzer Hara, the libidinal instinct, is a much stronger one. Generally, it's always easier to go low than to go high. Then we have the both sides of the verse. If you do good, you stand up straight. If you don't do good, sin crouches at the door. What is the door? The door is, after all, the symbol of what? Of activity, of motion, of going in and coming out, of progress of man's life, the development of man's life. Then sin is always waiting at the door, about to pull you down. V'yelecha teshuka, so he wants to get at you. V'yata timshel bo. This ata timshel bo is the optimistic conclusion. God says to me, you have a free choice. In other words, you can be good or be bad. But above all, remember this. It's true that sin crouches at the door. It's true, as I say, that it's easier to fall down than to rise up. But remember at all times that you have the choice. The ata timshel bo. Man is never pre-doomed. Man is never doomed by an original sin which he can only be saved by some magic. The ata timshel bo. Man always has it within his power to rule over sin, to control sin.
Is the word chatat feminine or masculine?
It's a very good question.
Because this shukaton seems to infer masculine.
Yeah, evidently it's used in masculine. One of the reasons it's a difficult construction. Unless chatas is one of those many Hebrew words, or one of those few Hebrew words, that is both masculine and feminine. There are certain words. Now, Hirsch points out something very, very interesting. This word, v'eilecha teshuka so v'ata timshel bo. Do any of you recognize this verse?
Yeah.
Where?
with the Adam and Eve.
Yes, that what point?
You shall rule over her.
Where? Let's look for that. You guess.
A few pages two before.
Page before, page 5, verse 16. Elisha Amad, this is God's curse. First he curses the man, then he curses the woman. Amad, first the serpent, then the woman. He says, Harbe arbe itzvonech, I will increase your anxiety, or your behedonech, 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 tail dibonim, the idea of the anxiety of birth. V'elishech teshukasech, and to him, to your husband, will be your longing. V'hu yimshel bach, he will be Moshel, he will rule over you. Now, this is almost the same construction here. V'elecha teshukaso, v'ata timshel bo. In other words, that Hirsch, Samson Raphael Hirsch, points out that here you have a very subtle understanding. What is teshukaso? You will long for him. It means you will long to have to be loved by him. Here, sin will be longing, has a longing for you. What does it mean, a longing? If what God meant to say, what the Torah meant to say, is that sin longs to control you, then the word teshuka is wrong. Teshuka is more of a, how should I put it? If what sin wants to do is to control you, then it wouldn't be teshuka. Teshuka means a love relationship, in the sense of wanting to be possessed and held and loved by someone else. So he points out as follows, that this is the same, is similar in meaning to what God said previously to Eve. And that is as follows, that sin will be longing to you. What does it mean to long for you? That although sin crouches at the door and will pull you down, at the very same time, paradoxically, sin has a longing to be ruled by you. Sin is there but wants to be possessed, it wants to be curbed, it wants to be controlled. And what he has in mind here is a statement by the Talmud that every day the Yetzer Hara appears before the Rabbanu Shalom, beautiful Agada, before the Kisei HaKavod, before the Divine Throne, and it cries. So God says to the Yetzer Hara, why are you crying? So the Yetzer Hara says, so-and-so, speaking about the whole world, each and every individual, this day had a chance to control me, and he didn't exercise the opportunity, he let me get the better of him, so I'm crying. V'yelecha teshukaso, the Yetzer Hara, or sin, wants to be controlled and circumscribed by you. He wants you to be the one to hold, to hold the reins of him. If you don't do it, then it's your own fault. V'ata timshobo, you can do it. So that this would mean that sin was placed in the world for the reason of being abolished. Sin exists so that man can destroy it. It doesn't make sense. I'll tell you why. Saadia, for instance, who was the first rationalistic Jewish philosopher we have. Now, I answered quickly because I anticipated the question. It would seem it doesn't make sense. But actually, it makes sense because this is what makes the world go round. Saadia, for instance, asked the question, why do you have to have commands and prohibitions? Saadia believed that reason can discover everything. He says, why didn't God give man a perfect reason instead of an imperfect reason? And man will do all the good in the world, and he doesn't have to have a Torah. He doesn't have to have revelation to tell him what's good and what's not good. And then why does he have to have commands and prohibitions he doesn't understand? What's the reason for it? So Saadia says, because in order for God to establish a relationship with man, he wants to make it so that he can give him something which will give man reward and happiness by virtue of his doing it, even if he otherwise would not. So that, taking two classes of reward, of commands, of laws, and this is part of his whole philosophy of law, incidentally. He says, those things which are self-understood, those things which are not self-understood, God gave to man, because man otherwise would not do them. Now that man does do them, when he observes both the positive and the negative, the command and the prohibition, he has a closer relationship with God, and therefore a more meaningful life, a happier life, and a more rewarding life. Because, he says, there is more achievement in obedience and in following a natural penchant for the good. Similarly, the second class of rational laws, of things I would do myself, for instance, to give the poor charity. The Torah tells me to do it. If the Torah wouldn't tell me, wouldn't I do it? I would also do it. So why do I have to have the law for? Because if I do it now, then I am not only being a good individual towards my fellow man, I'm also being a good individual insofar as living in consonance with the command and the edict of God. Which means my reward, in any way you want to place it, whether sophisticated or naive interpretation, my reward is that much greater. And this, in other words, means that without command and prohibition, without sin, man would live an absolutely static life. He would be like the angels, who are very, very pure, but very dull. I mean, there's no achievement, there's no progress. There's no strife, there's no struggle, and therefore there's no triumph in life. With man, what is it that makes man unique? That he has the freedom of will. Well, if there would be no sin, there would be no freedom. What is freedom for? An angel is not free. An angel is not free because he has no yetzer hara. Only when you face the possibility of failure can you succeed. A man who comes into an inheritance of $10 million is not a success in life. Not at all, unless he takes the $10 million and devotes himself thereafter, like some of like Chester Bowles, to international statesmanship and becomes a success. But a man who starts with nothing and makes $10 million is a success because he faced the possibility of failure. In other words, all of life is the antagonism, the encounter of good and evil. Then you can really be good. If there is no encounter with evil, there can be no good. Am I making myself clear, or am I being a bit circuitous? Yes.
You went over one point, I think, that could be brought up at this time, and that of faith.
Yeah.
By following the precepts of the irrational, so to speak, you must follow it on the assumption of faith, or else you would not. In other words, by just saying rationally, well, this is out of the question, the irrational tells you that you shouldn't do this, that it is, there's no reason to. But you say to yourself, because I have faith, and it's God-given or it's total or it's godly, I will follow these laws and these commandments. Therefore, it is creating or endowing yourself with greater faith in God.
100% right. I would make one qualification, not qualifying what you say, but one pre-statement, and that is this, that both the rationalists and the anti-rationalists in Judaism, and there's a wide range of feeling. There are those who are very strong rationalists, such as Sa'adia, Maimonides. There are those who are anti-rationalists, such as, to an extent, Yehuda Halevi. To a very great extent, certain Hasidic traditions, such as Rav Nachman Bratslava, who made one statement, well, I'll mention the statement later if you remind me, which is very powerful, and some of the Hirschian schools, such as Dr. Yitzhak Breyer, the grandfather of the present Breyer, who was a very profound thinker and anti-rationalist. We have many traditions, but all of them agree that there is nothing in the Torah that is counter to reason. There may be many things in the Torah which reason would not say you have to do it, but there is nothing in the Torah that reason says it's impossible to do this. If they have problems, they discuss it, but this is their general approach. Now, with what you say, you're 100% right. If the Torah told us only those things which were self-evident to our reason, then who needs a Torah? Then what virtue is there in being a faithful Jew or a faithful human being? Then religion is meaningless. Then why be religious? If the whole thing is self-evident, then I can be a perfect atheist and do the same things, because look, what is self-evident to your intelligence is self-evident to my intelligence too. The structure of reason can be broken down to mathematical equations ultimately, which is independent of our minds, independent of our personality. So that it is precisely that part of Torah which is beyond our reason, that the obedience to which makes us faithful Jews and distinguishes us, let's say, from people who have no religion. Because if all of it were understood, there would be no distinction between religious and irreligious, and there would be no virtue accruing to anyone who does it. Interesting thing. You know, do we make a bracha on a mitzvah when we perform a mitzvah? We do, don't we? Some examples. What's that? Tefillas Yadayim. What else?
Mostly
is on eating. I'm talking about the mitzvah there. That's the bracha of eating. It's not a mitzvah to eat. Esrig, Kaniga, Tfilin, Talis, candles. What do all these have in common?
They're irrational.
They're irrational. They're not necessarily things I might discover by myself. Do you make a bracha on the social laws? Such as, it's a mitzvah to love your neighbor. When you walk past your neighbor's door, do you look at the door longingly and say, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kedeshanu Mitzvosa V'Tzivanu Leha Uvesareyim, to love my neighbor. Nonsense. When you give charity, do you make a bracha? No. There's another reason for that, you know. The reason for that, they say that there's no bracha on tzedakah, because if there were a bracha on tzedakah, Jews are very pious. So they would first wash their hands or go to the mikveh. They make a long yihiratzim before that and make all kinds of preparations. By the time they got around to giving the tzedakah, the poor man would die of hunger. But actually, we don't make a bracha on the social laws or on rational laws. Why? So the one of the early scholars of Elkeach, also one of the late Gaonim, the high Gaon, who lived 1,000 years ago, gives this interpretation, which I think is very profound. What is the formula of the bracha over a mitzvah? Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who has done what?
Commanded us.
Who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us to do thus and thus. In other words, the only time that you can make that blessing is when your action is completely and utterly only because God commanded you. But if your action is only partly because God commanded you and partly because it's an intelligent individual who has ethical instincts, I know why I ought to do it, then you can't make the blessing. If I give tzedakah, I may give tzedakah and say, God, I'm doing this because it's good for a Jew to do this. But I also do it because I have compassion on my neighbor. And I do it because I simply have decent instincts. It isn't completely because God commanded me. When I put on film, if it's not because God commanded me, why then am I doing it? I'm not doing it because it's a rational thing to do. Because if it is, then why doesn't Chreis, any of the intelligent non-Jews, do it? So there I do it only because of a command. When I do a thing only because of a tzivano, what happens? What do I do to my life? What do I increase? Kiddushanu, holiness. You achieve holiness. What does holiness mean? Self-transcendence. How do you transcend yourself? How do you grow above yourself? When you obey that which is above your own reason. When you set yourself, attune yourself to that spirit which is above your own limited reason. So that all these revelational laws, the laws which aren't specifically rational, lead, the Vitzivanu laws lead to Kiddushanu, to Kedusha. And therefore we make the blessing only over them. They particularly are the ones that we do. Incidentally, they also teach us something about human intelligence. And that is that Judaism has always believed in the great power of the human mind. It has always denied the unlimited powers of the human mind. We have always believed that the human mind should be used. We are probably the only religion that has made a mitzvah of intellect, study. And yet, the very fact that we have revelational laws, laws that are above human reason, means that we've always maintained that the human mind is not unlimited. In the 18th century, this was a very unmodern idea. In the 20th century, it's very modern. Because today we know that the human brain is limited in scope. That there are certain things forever beyond our ken. Today there are equations in modern nuclear physics. Psi functions, are you taking physics? Other such things. Which maintain that there is in our very approach to the world, there's a distortion, and we can never get a really accurate picture of the world. We can never get a total picture of the universe. The universe is infinitely more complex than we ever imagined, and so complex that our human minds will never be able to fathom it. And certainly principle also, psi functions, correspondence theory, and so on. The whole structure of modern physics is based on this idea. And besides, we've learned simply that there is so much more to know than we've ever thought before, that we can never know it. I mean, we know that we'll never, for instance, travel at the rate of speed of light. And therefore, unless we begin to live 1,000,000 years, we'll never reach certain planets, and we'll never know what's on them. In the 18th century, this was in the realm of possibility, because we thought that nothing could be unknown to man. Hasidim say, incidentally, that that's why Jews wear a yarmulke. Kippah. They say, why? This is a Hasidic word. It's not the real reason that they invented the yarmulke, but ex post facto, you know, looking backwards, it's a very beautiful reason. They say clothing is worn for two reasons. One is for warmth, and the other is for modesty. Modesty. You wear a covering on your head for two reasons. One, to cover it. The second, for modesty. intellectual modesty. We recognize before God that ein chachma ve'ein tzivuna lefanav, that before Him we have no wisdom, we have no understanding, that our intellect is limited. We don't have what the Greeks called, you know the word?
Hubris.
H-U-B-R-I-S. Which means intellectual chutzpah. To think that I know everything and I can know everything. This is the Dor HaAflaga. So that the yarmulke in the sense, or actually speaking, not in the veritable sense, but in the actual sense, a bracha, and the whole existence of revelational laws, attest to the fact that the Torah demands of man that he uses intellect, but never become intellectually arrogant.
What is the real reason for wearing a yarmulke?
That's a very good question. The yarmulke has a number, and so we're trying to trace it. The yarmulke does not begin as a din. It is a din. It is a law. Originally it was a law only when praying and when making a bracha, and therefore eating the first kazayas. Those who were Adam Chashiv, people of station, important people, wore a yarmulke always. The ordinary mass of people did not wear a yarmulke. As time went on, everyone became an Adam Chashiv. Everyone became an important person, and everyone began to wear a yarmulke all day. So that the custom varies, the law remains that when eating and when praying, making a bracha, there should be a yarmulke. Insofar as other times, it's minhag, important minhag, but let's say German Jews very rarely, they don't wear a yarmulke at all except when praying. East Europeans did, so that here it's a matter of important minhag. There are those who say that the word yarmulke, yud reish mem lamed chaf aleph, yarmulke, is a contraction of yerei malka, fear is the king, fear of heaven. Who knows? No one knows where it comes from. It's like the word daven. I saw as recently as 4 months ago in one of the journals of one of these scientific Jewish journals, a whole linguistic description of daven from the Latin, from the Greek, and from ancient German, trying to put it together. I heard someone say it comes from the French. Assimilated from the French, devant, in front of. Look, see, what does the sign up there say? Know before whom you stand. Before whom you stand means God. Devant, before whom you stand. Davan means to stand devant, before God. Odenu omei lefnei Hashem. When Abraham davens, the Torah says he is standing before God. Devant le Dieu.
Maybe it's kind of a little too far, but you could say that.
Yes, it's almost as far-fetched as the French. It's a good try, though, Joe.
Well, also, divin is French, divine.
Divin, perhaps. That will be closer, because that will be a general Roman, a romantic root. Divine, divin, perhaps. Perhaps. But it's one of those strange words. We don't know where it comes from. Yarmulke. The word yarmulke, I saw another write-up recently. You can tell which part of Europe a man comes from, a Jew comes from, by the way he pronounces it. There are some who say yarmulke. There are those who say yarmulke. Yarmulke. And this Weinreb is a professor of Yiddish at the city of Columbia. It has a whole series. He says, hear a man speak Yiddish. He says, let him just say the word for the skullcap. And I'll tell you exactly where he comes from. He'll identify the geographic region exactly by his pronunciation of that one word. So you see how important the yarmulke is? Pardon?
About a couple.
Couple. I say couple too. Couple means a cap, a small cap.
That's already.
You're from the word cap. Couple is a small cap, diminutive cap. All right. Further. Verse 8, Vayomer Kayan. Yes, Jerry. You see, I learned your name this week. You signed Jerry last week. Oh, I was calling you Jed. I looked at the list and it says Jerry, so I thought I made a mistake again. Mr. Abrams?
Yes.
You made a name for yourself tonight.
The verse starts off, Halom take peace to A.
Yes.
Why doesn't it finish off that in the same with the same construction? But rather it says, it sort of leaves that construction, it says, Lateta Hatat Mavet. Why shouldn't it say that just as you will be uplifted, such will you be formed? The verse doesn't seem to
it go, yes, it occurs in a bit with a bit of circumlocution. If you don't do good, then God sort of hints, the Torah hints at it. Remember that there's a sin waiting to pull you down. Now, actually, if you're not completely satisfied, I can't blame you. You know what the rabbis of the Talmud said about this? That they pointed to this verse, they said, Zem min ha-mikra'os she'en lehem hechreya. One of those verses to which there is no satisfactory explanation. So if the rabbis of the Talmud despaired of finding an accurate interpretation, I won't have anything against you if you reject some of mine.
Rabbi, getting back to Yarmulke for a second, are there any regulations as to the size of it? They're getting smaller and smaller.
Well, Israel has a remarkable capacity. As they're going into atomic science and getting to subatomic particles, the Yarmulke is shrinking along with it.
Now, really, that is kind of an important question.
Yes, well, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a question. I wouldn't make an issue of it. Frankly, I couldn't wear one of those small things. I think it lacks all the Adam Chashev aspect. but I would not make it. Yes, the bobby pins are twice as big as the yarmulke now.
Is there something in this? I was once wearing one of these little things on a shul in Los Angeles. A man came over to me and he said, it has to be the size of your fist. It made me put on a big one. Anyway, put that
well, it depends on the size of your fist, I suppose, too. I don't know.
Your fist, the same as your head?
I wouldn't make it. Well, of course, I mean, after a while, there are no real regulations of that, because it wasn't the din to begin with, that sort. But, look, if you go too small, it becomes simply ridiculous. It becomes a sign that your religion is getting smaller and smaller. All right? So what happens to Ken? Now, what is the next five words? What is that? Vayomer Kayan El Hevelokim. What does the English say? Talked with Abel his brother. Well, that's trying to get out of a hard one. What does Vayoma really mean? He said. Now, if he said, it has to be followed by a quotation, right? What is the quotation? Nothing. No quotation. What happened to the missing verse? It's not there. So that this also is a very difficult half verse. A friend of mine, who is a Semitic scholar, maintains that the word amor, to say, originally comes from the word to blow up, to puff up. When you want to talk, you start exhaling, and you exhale, you puff up. You sit silently without saying a word. You just sit. You start talking, you puff up a bit. So the word amor has the connotation of puffing up, and puffing up also means in what? In anger. Similarly, we have Hashem in Devarim he'emircha hayom. God speaks to Israel. The Lord made you amor today. What does amor mean? Big. Gave you cognition. Give you recognition.
Does that mean rebuke?
No. No, Hashem ha'amir ha'yom, he praised you. He lifted you up. How? Again, from the idea of blowing up. He points it from other cognate roots. This would mean, when Cain saw his brother Hevel, he puffed up in what? In rage. He was enraged at him. And what happened? It was when they were in the field that Cain rose up above his brother Hevel. Notice the constant expression of his brother. To emphasize the fact that whom is he killing? His own brother. It's fratricide. Vayahar Geyu, and he murdered him.
You know, Rabbi, Terence.
Yes?
Terence says that, since Torah leaves out a lot of words which have to be understood, and it's that Cain spoke to Abel and said, let's walk in the field or something, but the next part is, and when they were in the field.
Yeah, that's the usual explanation, because there actually is something missing. There is something missing. Yes, Jeff.
I think it's true, but I don't remember who said it. I really think that he traces the Ugaritic or Sumerian root and finds that this word has some relationship to a post or a meeting place. And as if he established a meeting place with Hevel. And when they were there,
you have to rely here upon artificial explanations, because the verse is a very difficult one. It's an extremely difficult one. All right. Now what happens? Then the Lord sees kindness, says, where is your brother Hevel? He says, I don't know. My brother is keeper. And he says, what did you do? The voice, the sound of the blood of your brother is shouting to me from the earth. Therefore, accursed be you from the earth which opened its mouth to drink the blood of your brother. You will be accursed. And what will happen? The earth will not give you its produce, and you will be forced to become a wanderer and a fugitive, and nav-a-nad. This, in other words, indicates that murder is what kind of crime? A cosmic crime. Murder is not merely an offense against one individual, but if you murder one individual, then the whole world is offended. The very earth, Mother Earth, becomes offended because you destroyed one of her creatures. Remember what Ramban said? When God says, Nasa Adam Betzalmenu, let us make a man in our image, what does that us mean? Whom is he speaking to? Ramban says he's not speaking to the angels, as Rashi said, but whom then to? To the earth. God and earth cooperate to even the natural element and the divine element. And so that when man is murdered, then Mother Earth, literally Mother Earth, the forebear of man, is offended. His crime becomes a cosmic crime, a universal crime. Where else do we have that in the famous statement of the Mishnah? Kol ha-ma'abed nefesh achas, ki'ilu ibed olam malei. V'kol ha-ma'kayem nefesh achas, ki'ilu kiyem olam malei. Whoever destroys one person, it's as if he destroyed a whole world. Because man is unique and irreplaceable, because murder is a cosmic crime. And whoever saves a soul, it is as if he had saved an entire world. Now, I'm trying to... Yes, sir, Bob.
Why was the question asked, where is Zabel, my brother?
Oh, well, this, as we tried to explain last week, this is a sarcastic, the same way as God, when God talks to Adam, he says, where are you? In other words, you're hiding. Where are you means, what is a rhetorical question, because what is the real answer? I'm hiding. Well, why are you hiding? Because you're guilty. You're guilty. Why do you have guilt feelings? Because you're guilty. In other words, it's the accusing voice of conscience. Where is your brother Abel? What does he have to answer if he's going to tell the truth? I murdered him. See, it's not because God doesn't know, it's because God wants man to know. God asks a question for man to answer, not for him to answer, because God already knows it. Ey Hevel Achicha, you are your brother's keeper. Don't deny it.
Now we have confessed this to it, though. He doesn't seem to have any real children.
Who? Cain?
Does he?
Well, later on he does. When he says the words, when God gives him the punishment, he says, Godol, verse 13. And Cain says to the Lord, Godol avoni minasel. My sin is more than I can bear. It's too great. It's too great to be forgiven. What does the English say?
My punishment.
Of course, what the word avon means is my sin is too great to bear. In other words, Cain comes to a realization of how, and he doesn't come to the realization until he's punished, like many of us. It's a human failing. We don't realize the dimensions of our wrongdoing until we suffer the consequences. Then we really regret having done it. But it takes punishment frequently to make us aware of the nature of the crime. So he says the sin is too great to be forgiven, but God tells him it's not so. Now, this, yes?
This may be a question it's going to be difficult to ask him, but could it be that he's really not sorry, but he's just that he's sorry about the punishment? In other words, he wouldn't have been caught. He wouldn't have...
Well,
felt
it's conjecture.
Or
I don't.
Just that,
it's hard to say.
Moment of passion, and then after that he would.
Who knows? Who knows? I mean, it's a hard thing to read back into his mind. We have no indication, one way or another. Yes, sir.
I think he brought up a point. In other words, Cain talked to Abel. I think that this was premeditated.
Well, yes, it was a premeditated sin. Oh, premeditated? I don't know. How do you get that feeling?
Because the word vayomer, if you would talk with somebody or say something to somebody, you were thinking about it. It wasn't a moment of rage that came up when he killed his brother.
All right. If you say puffed up, then it does not make it a premeditated crime. Then it makes it a crime of of passion or anger. Let me show you. Well, it's a very good point, but let me show you why I would just an immediate reaction, a spontaneous reaction, why I would disagree with you. Where is the parsha of
sort of in revenge for the sacrifice?
What's that?
Isn't it in revenge for the sacrifice?
Well, he had been bearing an old grudge against him. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that he premeditated at the very beginning. I can be bearing a grudge against you with no intent to murder. But at one moment I turn around and I kill you.
Well, this is still the motive. We have a motive.
No, he's your father. There's no Bar Kriya here, is there? Do you recall when the Torah gives the law of Nara Hamarasa, a young girl who's engaged, or more than engaged, but Erison. And, what does the Torah say? Two cases. If the man who violates her, the adulterer, will find her in the city, if he will find her in the city, which means that there are people who can protect her, but she simply didn't shout, she didn't ask for help, which means she was satisfied with the arrangement. It was a case of fornication. Then she is guilty and he is guilty. But what happens in basade yimtsa? He will find her in the field where there is no great population. The girl will cry out, there will be no one to help her. Then he gets the death penalty, she does not. Why? Because it's no longer fornication, it's rape. In other words, the word sade is used to indicate a suddenness involved.
No, on the contrary, if the suddenness would be indicated by the city, for he would know that she could be rescued. And
perhaps, maybe you're right. It's true, maybe so.
In other words, if I were going to kill a girl, I would take her to Central Park like it happens every day in the city. You find probably more stabbings in Central Park than you would on the street corner for that reason that I'm out to kill someone.
Perhaps so. That may be a point. But Yomer, he talked him, in other words, he talked him into coming into the field and then he pounced upon her murder.
In the past when they were in the field.
Yes. Very possibly. Very possibly so. Yeah, you probably are right there. Let me give you now another interpretation of the whole episode that I think is a great deal of insight, because it's another way of looking at Chumash. I must confess that I've given it this at the center before, both in writing and orally, but I have a great deal of confidence that either you haven't read it or heard it, or if you have, that you've conveniently forgotten it. And that is this. This is a modern writer, a contemporary of ours, a very top-notch stylist and a man with a great deal of exegetical insight. He sees in Cain and Hevel a parable for our own times. I want to tell you that I'm giving more of my interpretation in it, but I'm using some ideas that I found in Eldad. What is Cain's profession? What is his profession?
Fruit.
Oved Adama. Farmer. Worker of the earth. What is Hevel's profession?
Shepherd.
A shepherd. What is Cain's name? Cain. Where does it come from? Kinyan. What does Kinyan mean? Acquisition. To acquire. To gain. To get more. What does Hevel mean? Nothingness. The vapor of the mouth dissolves. Cain and Hevel represent two aspects of man. Cain, being Kinyan, acquisition, represents the progressive element. The element that wants to build, that wants to grow, that wants to acquire, that wants to get more, that wants to accomplish and construct. After all, the work of the what does a shepherd do? He merely has to see to it that the wolves don't attack. Otherwise, he lets the sheep grow by themselves, they graze. He doesn't do anything. He's a protector. He's a shomer. He's a shomer. A protector. He doesn't work. He doesn't build. He's passive. The man who's a farmer has to bend down, plow, dig, fertilize, weed, prune, until he finally sees the sprouts coming out and the fruit harvested. He's got to work an awful lot. He's a progressive individual. And if he plants a little bit, he gets a little. If he plants a lot, he gets more. So he is the one who is the progressive person, the one who kinyan. He's constantly growing. You have two personalities, and they're revealed in the names. Kayin, getting more. Hevel, passive, quiet. He's short-lived. They represent, on the one hand, the progressive or technological aspect of man, and Kayin represents the moral aspect, the ethical aspect. Pardon? What? No, I'm sorry. Kayin represents progressive, progress, technology, work, avoda, oveda dama. Hevel represents morals, ethics, shmira, lishmorat haShabbat, to observe the Sabbath, to be a shomer. Do you recognize the words oved and shomer from before Kayin and Hevel? Ah, what happens when God places man in the Garden of Eden? What does he command him to do? What is man's function in paradise? La'avda u'lishomer, to be an oved and a shomer, to be a worker and a keeper. What does it mean? To plow, to till the ground, also to keep, to have a moral restraint over his progress and over his technological dung, his technological urge. What happens after man is chased out of the Garden of Eden? It splits. He goes into two individuals. Not only two sons biologically, but mankind splits into the workers, the scientists, the technologists, and the moralists and the moralizers, the Kayins and the Hevels. Those who have only avoda in their lives, only the power, the desire for power and conquest, and those who have in their lives only the passive morality of holding where you are and trying your best to be as moral as you can within a kind of flashback to the past, living in antiquity, but living clean, purely, and antiseptically. So you have these two that are separated. La'avda and la'shamra are separated. What happens when you separate them? What happens if you're only a moralist without having touch with progressive, dynamic life? Hevel, you die. You die. You get killed in the race for life. Very simply so. If you try to keep out of the movement of life, the motion of man and history, and try to be like the Essenes were, like the sect that made the Dead Sea Scrolls were, you're going to disappear. You have no choice. In a power-conscious world, a complete renunciation of power may be very good intentions, but you're not going to survive. And the whole moral purpose which you want to serve is hevel. It vaporizes. It's nothing. Shmira alone is impossible. What happens if you have only Kayin? If you're only an Oved? Look at the consequences. If you're only a technologist and you abandon, you say that, look, I'm a scientist, nothing to do with ethics, I'm ethically neutral. Or I'm an engineer, what are you bothering me with this nonsense about religion and ethics and morals? Talk about it in your philosophy class. I'm an engineer, my job is to make atom bombs. Bigger and better hydrogen bombs. I can now have something which kills another million people. I'm a better man than you are. What do you want to bother me about scruples, moral scruples? After all, it's a whole part of our society. Of course, there are people who have combined them both, and we all know who they are. But the great majority of the scientific community, let's say, doesn't know such things. Or the business community, which develops a whole industry or a whole economy. Generally, you want to be honest in business, my friend, stay in the rabbinate. This is the more than one person who's wanted to go into business has been told this. In other words, this is a cutthroat competition. In my line, you can't be too honest. Can't be fair. You keep the law if you have to, but as far as you can go otherwise. Well, what happens when you have this kind of attitude towards life? Towards the dynamics of life. Only an oved and not a shomer. Look at the consequences. Consequence number one, you destroy life. If you're only a shomer, you are destroyed. What happens if you're only an oved? You're a murderer. And do you notice what happens when man, the oved, the Kayin murders, and God challenges him, why did you do it? What does he say? What are his famous words? Hashomer achi anochi, what do you want from me? I'm not an oved, I'm not a shomer, I'm an oved. My brother, he was the shomer, he was the good fellow. This is what happens to the good guy, you see. But me, I'm a professional oved, I'm a technologist. This is part of my job and the development of my industry or my science or my engineering. I kill the fellow. Well, you have to have sacrifices if you want life to progress. Hashomer achi anochi, I'm not a shomer. He's a shomer, I'm not a shomer. I have a different function. Furthermore, in the same line, in the same consequence, you find that the Oved destroys himself. Look at what happens very interestingly. You wonder otherwise why the Torah tells you this story. Look at what happens with the grandchildren of Cain. The same page. No, not the same page, the next page. The top of the page, verse 20 and 21 and 22. She gives birth, in other words, Lamech's wife gives birth to Yovel. What is he? Yoshev Oel Mikna. He is the, he takes care of the office of agriculture. The next one is Yuva. What does he do? Tofes Kino Vugov, the arts. He builds Lincoln Center. Zila, what does he do? She gave birth to Tuval Kain. What does he do? He's in industry. Lotesh Kolchoresh Nechoshes Ubarzel. He is an artificer in every article of copper and iron. You have a whole world here, all of civilization represented in these three. You have commerce, you have industry, and you have the arts. Well, it would seem very good. So progressive man has gotten himself a civilization, which is the result of Cain. Cain is a civilizer. Now what happens with Lamech? Lamech, he goes around and with the same artifacts which his son creates, he kills him. He murders him by mistake. In this giant, impersonal industry and commerce, there are innocent victims. As the wheels grind and no one cares, they become ciphers and they destroy themselves. Cain himself is ultimately destroyed by his grandsons, by the weapons forged by his technology. So what happens? I mean, it's the modern man. We are in danger now. Our own world is on the precipice of destruction. Who is going to destroy us? Technology. Our own avoda. What we have accomplished with our own avoda. Let's go to the next consequence. What's the next consequence of avoda without shmira? Of this technology that's not controlled by ethical restraint, of Cain without Hevel. What is the punishment that God condemns him to? Navanad. What does it mean? A sense of alienation. He no longer feels at home in the world. If you read Eric Fromm, or for that matter, any of the modern semi-existential psychologists and philosophers, what do you discover? That man suffers today from a tremendous sense of alienation. He simply doesn't feel at home in the world. Read Sartre, you'll find out that poignant anxiety. Why anxiety? Because he feels like a man from Mars suddenly landing on Earth in a jet in a interstellar craft. Where am I? What am I doing here? Who am I? What am I? I don't belong. Man doesn't feel at home. He works in a factory, and because of technology, because of avoda, the article he makes is no longer his own. He used to make a whole shoe. Now he bangs a nail into one corner of a sole, nothing more, all day long. He has no personal connection with it. He's not related to his product. He's not related to his family. He's not related to his city. He's only a cog on the wheel. So he's homeless. Man is homeless in the universe. He's Navanad. He's a wanderer. The earth has cursed him. What does it mean, earth has cursed him? It's cut off his relationships. He no longer feels at home in nature. We are no longer natural beings. Further, another thing that Eldad does not notice, but I think fits in very well with our scheme, a third consequence. This you'll have on page 6, verse 17. And Cain knew his wife, and she became pregnant, and she gave birth to Chanoch. What are the next words? Vayhi bon ha'ir. Who built the city?
Cain.
No.
Cain.
Wait, he built the city, but what did he do? What? He could stay there for 5 years or 2 years, build the city and go on. No, because he never settled in one place.
But this would seem to say that he did settle in one
place. No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. He built the city. He was wandering, but he came to this particular place. Look, what does the city mean in those days? Community. He built a small community. Doesn't mean he built in New York City.
But here, certainly, in contradistinction
to Navanad. No, not too much. I mean, I say a man is a wanderer. I mean, Robert Moses can go from town to town throughout the length and breadth of the land, stay in each place a couple of years, build a city, and he's a wanderer. Wanderer doesn't mean that every day he moves on. It means he's in a state of ferment. He's unsettled. But look, what does he do? Cain builds a city. It must mean Cain, because look at the last part. And he calls it by the name of his son, Chanoch.
You could say Beno, I think I saw something there. Beno is the person who builds it. Bonet, Beno.
That's a drasha.
No.
But let me show you what this means. Now, do you know what one of the commentators later called the Kliyukar? You know how he points out? How would you say, if the translation were correct, that he built a city, how would you say he built a city in Hebrew? Bona'ir, or Vayiven in biblical idiom. What does Vayibona'ir mean? He was building, he was constantly building. In other words, when man becomes an Oved without the element of Shmira, without moral restraint and consciousness, what happens? His progress becomes an obsession, an erotic compulsion. Vayibona'ir, to this day he's still building. After a while you work no longer because you have to have the money, but because you're so used to it, you keep on working. You build machines. You no longer have to have the machines, but industry must go on. The engineer doesn't know how to stop. He must keep on building it. And of course, if you ask him, why are you building the business anymore? You have enough for plenty. I mean, you can sit down now and retire and enjoy life and its arts and its sciences and its and religion and literature. I'm building it for my son. Gotta have it for my son, you see, you have to take care of him. There's always an excuse, but the neurotic compulsion must be satisfied because it's the result of Oved without Shomer. So you see how the whole picture of Cain and Abel is a commentary on modern man when he has separated the Avodah from the Shmira. Now, one last comment. Where do you find a reconciliation of both in Judaism, in modern life? Where does the Torah give us a temporary respite, a recess, from this neurotic Oved? Shabbos. How? More.
You're not allowed to create that.
More. What are the two key words in Shabbos? Avoda and Shmira. Lo Savod, you can't, what can't you do on Shabbos? Avoda. What then must you do on Shabbos? Be a Shomer Shabbos. The words reappear again. And the Garden of Eden comes back. If your week consists of 6 days of avoda, shesh yesh yamim tavod, of work, of creation, of progress, but one day of shmira, devoted to the soul, devoted to the spirit, devoted to God, then you have the combination of avoda l'shamra, which we first saw where? In paradise. So a life of Shabbos and weekday, in that proportion of 6 and 1, as the Torah commands, shesh yesh yamim tavod, and the 7th day you have shmira, then you have a reestablishment of Me'ein Olam Haba, as we call Shabbos, a reflection of paradise. Otherwise, if it's all week long Shmira, then of course man can't exist, it's Hevel, he must die young. If it's all week Avoda and never Shmira, then it becomes subject of the curse of Cain once again.